What happens when a kid grows up in poverty, watches his mom cut pills in half to stretch out her prescriptions? In this episode of the Big Fish Cares podcast today, I sit down with Jeff Hancher, Army veteran, Fortune 500 leader, author of this book right here, Firm Feedback in a Fragile World. When you look in the mirror these days, what part of your past still shows up in your eyes?
I would say it's the pain. My teenage years, I was a bona fide criminal. I was a modern day Robin Hood. There was a ton of dysfunction in my house. There was very little to no direction, not because my parents didn't love me and my brother, because they were literally fighting for their life. I was mad at God, because if there was a God, why would I be in this mess?
You know, is your work actually leadership?
I believe what I'm doing is what I'm called to do. I believe what I'm doing is what I was put on this planet to do. You become a leader that people don't want to let down. That hits different.
Welcome to the Big Fish Cares podcast.
In this episode of the Big Fish Cares podcast today, I sit down with Jeff Hancher, Army veteran, Fortune 500 leader, author of this book right here, Firm Feedback in a Fragile World. But this just isn't really about leadership. It's about healing those father wounds that a lot of men have, the fragile beginnings that a lot of us entrepreneurs have come out of to get where we're at today. But we still know that there's more. Jeff tells us in a very loving and authentic and bold way how to be able to lead better, right? How to be able to give good feedback in a loving way through some of the things he's learned in his life. Jeff opens up like I've never seen him open up before. I don't think he's ever had a podcast like this yet. And, you know, if you lead people, if you're a parent, you're going to want to watch this episode. This, to me, is the best episode. And I've done a lot of good episodes. You guys know that. This has been the best episode that we've ever done on the Big Fish Cares podcast. This is going to hit you in your heart. Grab a couple Kleenexes and just pause the noise. Just stop doing whatever you're doing and buckle into this one and be present with it. This one will change your life. Jeff, I want to start right here. Thanks for being here, by the way.
Yeah.
With a question I don't think you get asked that often.
Hmm.
When you look in the mirror these days, what part of your past still shows up in your eyes?
Hmm. I would say it's the pain. And let me expound on that a little bit. You know, I came through a lot of trauma as a child. I would say early in adulthood, when I would reflect on the pain, it was scars. It was a lot of healing, led to a lot of imposter syndrome, a lot of bad decisions. But as I've matured through that, I can still look in the mirror, see that same pain. But that pain has now taught me something. You know, I've learned that we all get adversity. It's common ground that every human being has. What we get the option to do is to figure out, is this adversity going to be a propeller or is it going to be an anchor? There was a portion of my life that the adversity led to it being an anchor. Bad decisions, brushes with the law, alcohol abuse, name it. But there came a point in my life where enough was enough, and I could let that pain that I still see in the mirror be a propeller for me and work for my good. And so I still see it because I don't want to forget what that felt like, because in some ways I'm playing the underdog theme, and it motivates me to do more and to serve more people.
Do you think it's always going to be like that?
In some ways I hope so. Mm. I don't want to forget where I came from. You know, I want to give back to a community that might be going through the same challenges that I went through. You know, success comes with benefits. And there's the natural ones that some people chase, which is wealth and things and houses and cars and all those. And those things are great. And I think it's great to have those things. But I think the real definition of success in building that kind of life is what you can do for other people. And when I leave this world, Benny, I want people to be glad I was here and very sad that I'm gone. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way. Mm-hmm. I mean that as I want to make impact. Mm-hmm. You know, it's why I left the job that I loved, and it's why I do what I do. And so I don't want to lose that edge And forget, you know, where I came from, because I think it does motivate me and propels me, gives me a little bit of healthy fear too, you know, to keep playing the underdog theme.
The only reason I ask you that is because sometimes I think that entrepreneurs, because that's how I would say 95% of entrepreneurs, and I just made that number up because that's what most of us do. We just make numbers up.
Make it believable.
But I believe, though, that most of us get propelled from the pain, right? The ones that are, you know, doing podcasts, the ones that are doing the things. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a fear that's inside of us that if we don't have that, we're not going to know how to be.
Yeah.
And so that's why I asked you that.
Oh, yeah.
Just because, like, do you feel that too? Like, it's like, oh, we don't know another way. So, like, we're just going to keep.
Yeah.
We're just going to keep. Every time we get up on stage, or every time we start a podcast, we're going to start with the story, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to get on there a second. But, you know, I was talking to Gino Wickman about this, and it's like, we have to, there's got to be something else that can propel us. It can't always be like, hey, we're competing with ourselves from, you know, our childhood or our trauma, right?
Yep.
There's got to be a way that we can evolve and still make an impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find that about with money, with me, with money. I'm like, I always feel like I'm not going to have enough. And so, like, it's just constantly.
That's another thing.
It's constantly in my brain. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I don't know how to, I'm trying to beat it out of me.
Yeah.
But, like,
yeah.
Because it's like a weird, I don't need to try so hard anymore.
Yes.
But, like, I also
but that feeling will probably never leave you.
I know, but
and
I'm not even saying
it's bad.
Well, I don't think it's bad. I don't think it's bad. I just think, I wonder what could we learn if we could figure out how to operate from a place of gratitude and abundance and not always have to, like, worry about pain and lack and things like that. It's like, mm-hmm. what would our life look like? And I know it's scary because mm-hmm. we've never done it, but it's like a new skill that we'd have to learn.
Listen, it's something that I have worked through since, you know, becoming an adult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have not arrived by any stretch, but I'm certainly not where I started. But I still find myself in the grocery store sometimes figuring out which one gives me the better deal per ounce.
Well, you know, they already put that on the labels now. I look at it on the labels, it says 29 cents per ounce.
Well, you know what I do? I mean, sometimes what I'll do to shut my mind up is I'll just grab the whole rack, throw it in the cart, and buy it all.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to let you win. Mm. I'm not playing this game.
Yeah. And then give it to somebody on their way out.
Just
the door.
Give it to somebody, get, you know, whatever it might be. But I think it is a real thing. Mm. And here's another one that's the stepbrother of all this, which is imposter syndrome. Mm. Hey, look, you know what? I grew up poor. I never went to college. You know, the underdog mentality. And so every time a great opportunity comes, the first thing I go to is, well, I'm not qualified to do that. They surely got the wrong guy. But here's what I'm learning about imposter syndrome. The reason that I battle it so much is because I get discontent fast. If I start winning in a certain area, I'm over it. Mm-hmm. I got to go to a new room.
Because you like pain.
I love pain. It's a love-hate relationship. But every time that you go up, you advance, you go to the next level, you go into that level saying, I don't know what I'm doing. Mm. I'm not sure. They're going to know who I am. They're going to figure this whole thing out. But I go lean into that anyway. It's been probably the single biggest thing that has attested to any growth that I've had, is do it anyway.
If someone met you today, and I know you've had success, Fortune 500 success, best-selling author, about to be, right, with this book.
We're working on it.
This is your first
book,
right?
This is the one.
Right, so best-selling author.
There we go. Claim it.
It out. I feel like you're a very polished leader. You may not think that you are. You may, you know, still be winging it, which you just admitted to. But when I look at Jeff Hanscher, I look at, like, you know, buttoned up, got that corporate look, but also got that punchy entrepreneur, because you're, like, kind of got the best of both worlds going.
Mm, good.
And if someone met you today and they knew all those things about you, like your LinkedIn profile, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and had no idea, though, where you came from, what would they be most shocked about? Like, what part of your story would they be most shocked about?
Like, if my story was out there for everybody to know, and they are hearing it for the first time, kind of thing?
No, like, they just met you. They got introduced at a mixer event.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
got a nice polished suit
oh,
on.
Oh, yeah. And they're
you got your pretty wife next to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just like I saw you at the Rocco Cuzzo event, right? The gala. And, you know, they know your bio, right? Because they checked your LinkedIn before coming up to you.
Yeah.
They see all this stuff about
you. They think I got it all together.
Right. What part of your story would they be most shocked to hear?
All right.
The single biggest shock.
Yeah. I was on leave from the military. And now let me go back a little bit. I was, my teenage years, I was a bona fide criminal. I'm talking.
What was the worst crime you committed?
I'm about to tell you. Right. I was a modern day Robin Hood. You know, steal from the rich, give to the poor. Me being the poor, right? Me and my buddies, and I'm not going to call out names, but
we'll protect the innocent.
Yeah, protect the innocent. Hopefully, the statute of limitations is on my side. I have talked about this publicly, but not a lot. I was home on leave and got with my old crowd, my old buddies, and we did what we always did, which was grab, you know, several cases of beer, had the alcohol, and we're just having a good time. And we decide there was a need. I'll just leave it at that. There was a need that came up. And I said, well, we need to go to said neighborhood, more affluent, and do what we always do. Somebody grab the bolt cutters. Let's go. And so we would just go to sheds and bolt cut and take a tractor, mowers, whatever, and we would pawn, you know, we would sell them at like pawn shops or whatever it might be. And so we had been drinking all night. I was the least drunk of them, which wasn't saying much. But I'm the one that's going to be driving, and I'm driving my buddy's truck. It's not even my vehicle. And I'm home on leave from the military. So we do everything that needs to be done. We got all the goods in the back of the truck, everything that we needed to go to market tomorrow. It's probably 3:15, 3:20 in the morning. And I'm heading down a very busy road, not an interstate, but a busy road. And sure enough, coming this way is a state trooper. And I'm thinking, just play it cool and keep driving, no big deal. Well, I had been drinking a lot, so obviously, unbeknownst to me, I swerved into his lane. Not swerved, but went into his lane. So I'm looking in my rearview mirror, and sure enough, he turns around. Now it's me and a buddy of mine, and I said, hey, he's turning around. What are we gonna do? And he's like, it's your call, man, you're driving. And I said, I can't get caught, I'm on leave. So I floor it. I have all the goods in the back. I'm heading down this interstate in a four-wheel drive pickup suspended truck, and lights are on, and they're coming after me. Well, I knew this area that we were in very well. We're in the cut. We're in the country, and this is my turf. This is my domain. So I know if I can get on this one road, and I can get about 2 miles down this old country gravel road, there's a gate that goes to a field, and if I can get to that gate, there's no way they're gonna catch me. Well, one trooper ended up being two ended up being three, and they're coming after me on this gravel road. I'm going about 80 miles an hour on this gravel road, back end sliding the whole thing. I look up, I can almost see where I need to go. The problem was, coming up the road, you guessed it, was two or three more state troopers. So I have to punch it with everything I have to try to beat them to the point that I need to go. And that's when I flipped the truck. Not once, not twice, but it flipped six times down over a hill. The first thing that I said whenever the truck stopped rolling was, are you alive? And he said, my buddy said, I am. We land straight upright, and there's a gun pointing through the window. And all you hear is, don't move, of which I kicked the door open on my side and started running through an open field. So now there's a foot chase. I hit a tree, it's pitch black. I hit a limb of a tree that's coming down and cracked my orbital bone. And obviously they caught me and they took me in. The cliffhanger, I ended up not going to jail. My first sergeant came and represented me in court. We were on red alert for Cuba. He begged the court. He said, this guy deserves to rot in a jail cell, but you would be doing our country a disservice, and we need him. He's one of the best guys I have. And so they let me out without jail time, but I a stack of fines, probation, and everything that came with it. That was probably the, now look, we don't have enough time in this show to go around and talk about all the things that I did that I regret and I wish I could take back, but that one definitely makes the highlight reel. Not one I'm proud of, but I tell this story because there's probably...
I was probably the most well-spoken story that I've ever heard on the show before.
Well, I got to tell you, there's somebody that's going to... I've never told it on a show.
Well, the way that you tell it is like so like
no
masterful. Like it put me like right in that. And like so, I got a couple follow-up questions now.
Oh yeah.
What'd your buddy say? What happened to him? Is he okay?
Like
he
nothing was, happened he was okay? to him. Like everything. He was basically the victim, you know, of my nonsense.
Oh man.
But it was his truck. I felt horrible.
Did he have to go to jail or anything
no,
like that? Did
no.
they get you from the stolen equipment or anything or?
Benny, when I tell you...
Or did all the trucks fly out as you were driving down the gravel road?
I mean, it was stolen equipment. I mean, they got me for stop signs. I'm talking everything they could pin.
Did you get a felony at all?
No felony.
Wow.
No felony.
And you were what, 20?
19.
19, wow.
19 years old.
Well, that's a shocker. I didn't realize that story was coming
out. Now the world knows.
And that's not in the book.
That is not in the book. That might be book number two, sequel, maybe.
That's a book. From that, yeah.
You know, what's funny about that. When I met, I was having a meeting with my mentor about what to write the book about, and I told him I want to write it about my life, and I'm telling him stories, and he's like, no. He said, Jeff, nobody cares.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, Benny cares. He's like, no, nobody really cares. He said, write a book that's going to make impact first and give people a reason to care about your story. Well, how could I come on this show with however many people are going to listen to this show and tell them one of the most embarrassing stories in my life? It's really the question you opened with, is I don't look at that as pain of regret and anchor. I look at that as pain as propeller and promoter. And there's going to be one person, I hope, that listens to this show from a jail cell. And says,
sneaking it in on their iPod or something.
I get it. That's me too. I wasn't so lucky and I ended up in jail. Well, if you're listening, I'm here to tell you, your best days are ahead.
Wow. That's really good. Yeah, you're right. I could ask you 1,000 more follow-up questions about that. But
it was a rough night.
I'm going to put a bow on that. So I think you said in your book that statistically you should be dead, which that story definitely confirms that you should have at least died as a car accident or be in jail. For sure that should have happened, right? Like there's no doubt about that.
Multiple times.
You should have at least, and we don't have to get into all of that. Mm-hmm. But can you take me back to the reality of that statement? And what was the environment like growing up? How does someone become that as a teenager, as a young adult? Like what was your environment like?
Yeah, well, let me tell you how I found out that statistic, and then I'll reverse.
Okay.
So this event that I just told you about, this story, one of the things I had to do to not get a felony, to not go to jail, I had to go through these courses. And I had to answer questions. So I was like a lab rat, if you will. And they're asking me all kind of questions about my childhood and all of these things. And the more they started unpacking my life, the more intrigued they became. So they brought in more experts and all these people. And I literally felt like they're doing a whole life study on my story here. And so they asked me this series of questions in this one specific setting. And it was like 100 questions and I had to answer certain ways and it would spit out a number. That's where the stats came from. And this lady sat me down. She asked her whole entire team to leave. And she said, I want you to be very honest with me. And there's some hard things that I need to tell you. And she said, you've been with us now for months. And I just had you complete this questionnaire. And she said, do you know the probability of you even being alive today, how low it is? And never being incarcerated, it's unheard of. And I said something like, yeah, I'm pretty lucky. And she said, I don't think it's that. I don't know what it is. She said, but the odds that you would even live through what you've lived through, the decisions, like she said, I'm not making light of anything you've done, Jeff, but compared to what most people do, it's not even close. Like the fact that you've never been shot at, the fact that, and none of this has happened, is statistically overwhelming. Now, how did we get to those statistics? Well, I was born into poverty. Now, let me make a big deal about what I'm about to say. My parents were good people. They were good people, but they were not well. And I don't mean just financially. I mean, they were dealt some really bad cards. As juveniles, my mom was diagnosed with a disease called lupus. My dad, as a juvenile, was diagnosed with chronic osteoarthritis. That from the time I was born, neither one of them ever worked a day in my life. It was in and out of hospitals, in and out of surgeries, in and out of rehabs. That hard life led to bad decisions. You know, what you find about a lot of people that are in poverty is they make things worse. And so there was a ton of dysfunction in my house. There was very little to no direction, not because my parents didn't love me and my brother, because they were literally fighting for their life. And so it wasn't any problem to break all the rules, to blow past a curfew. You know, the things that went on in my bedroom shouldn't happen in most adult bedrooms. You know, I mean, we were not good kids. We were delinquents. Did we want to be good humans? Yeah. Zero direction. And when you give, you know, a child or a teenager that kind of freedom, it's a recipe for disaster. And that's really what was starting to take place in my life up to and leading to that moment.
Wow. So in the book, you say there's this image that stuck with you for a while, and it's your mom cutting pills in half to stretch, you know, from having to buy prescriptions.
That's
or whatever,
right.
What did that do to 7-year-old little Jeff? And what did it teach you about control and about helplessness and about hope?
Well, I think whenever there's nothing you can do about it, you feel helpless. And, you know, as a child and even somewhat as a teenager, you see the problem. You want to fix the problem, but the problem is way bigger than you. Like, you don't even know what to do. You know, I mean, I started my first company when I was 16. I worked since I was 10 years old. You know, I would grow produce and take it uptown in the red wagon and sell it in front of the bank. Like, you know, I was a grinder and a hustler from way back, but it was never enough to move the needle. What I found later was it was never going to be enough, you know, because there was mismanagement and all of these different things. But where that comes up in the book is, you know, Simon Sinek says it best when he says people will work for their what, but they'll die for their why. I didn't really realize how true that was until I found what motivated me most. And when I tell you, when I dig deep into what motivates me most, I will die on the hill chasing that thing down. And I had a boss one time that asked me this question, and it's one of my most favorite leadership questions that there is. He asked me, why is success important to you? And at this point, I had a relationship with him, but I wasn't ready to, you know, pull out all my dirty laundry and let them know that I came from the other side of the tracks. But I remember saying the words, I want my parents to be able to have the medicine that they need, is how I framed it. But what I was thinking of was seeing my mom cut a pill in half because the copay was so expensive, but it was medicine that she needed so desperately to be healthy or at least function. But she couldn't afford copays, so she would cut these pills in half, and it would break my heart. You know, when you sit and hold your mom as a 10-year-old, a 7-year-old, and you're the only one home and she's having another grandma seizure, it's traumatic. And when you know, like, there's medicine that she needs so these things don't happen and there's nothing you can do about it. Well, whenever, you know, I had a big boy job after transitioning from the military, I had a passion so deep in me, Benny. I didn't want them to have to need for the life's essentials. I wanted to get them out of the one bedroom apartment, not to mention my own family that I'm starting. If my son wants to play basketball someday and put a pair of J's on, he's going to. He's not going to wear the pro kids like I did and get made fun of and laughed at and feel like inferior. He's going to wear them. And whatever that means, that's what it means. You know, we talked about the chip on the shoulder. Mm-hmm. You know, working from behind, that can be a propeller, my friend. Mm-hmm. Yeah, almost to a fault.
So why don't you go get your kid the cheap pair of shoes from Kmart then?
He probably needs it. Build some character in him.
I'm just asking. I mean, that's intense, man. Wow. I think you painted a really good picture of what your life was like back in the day. Before you ever dreamed of, like, you know, the Jeff that I know, you gotta remember, I've only known you for a few months. Mm-hmm. Blessed to know you now. Wish I would have known you my whole life, but glad we have this experience today. Same. But, you know, I see Jeff, the speaker, you know, the host of the Executive Mastermind. And before you dreamed of all of that, stages and success and things like that, did young Jeff ever talk to God? And what were those conversations like, if they happened at all?
They did. Yes, he did. And thank God for praying grandmothers, you know, because it was, I spent quite a bit of my childhood with my grandmother. And she was a woman of prayer. You know, she was a warrior. She was somebody that never missed church. Mm. She was somebody that read me the Bible every day. She was somebody that prayed with me every day. You know, she would always read out of Jeremiah. And she would use my name. She would say, I know the plans I have for you, Jeffrey Chad. She would say my name, my middle name. You know, when grandma says your middle name, she's serious.
Yeah, she's probably getting the switch.
I have plans.
I have a grandma just like yours.
She had some switches too. But she would say my name and she would say, I have plans to prosper you. Mm. I'm going to give you a hope and a future. And she would just speak this over me, right? And so it was getting inside of me, and you would think through all of that, that I wouldn't have made so many bad decisions. But I often wonder back to that counselor that was like, it's a miracle you're still alive. I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, their miracles are happening. So yes, I would talk to God.
I mean, looking back now, it's easy for me to say, like, God was just, and I don't know if God does this or not, I'm always like on the fence. I would assume that he never wants you to do anything bad, but he also takes those, in your case and in my case, he takes those tribulations and those trials, right? And mm-hmm. then he actually transforms you.
Yeah.
Into, like, you know, you're only, how old are you right now? 50?
A couple weeks, I'm going to be 50, yeah, celebrating 50. The big 5-0.
Yeah, so by the time this thing's out, you'll be 50.
Yeah, I will be.
Yeah. But it's like, and you still got another 50 to go. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting, like, because I think that you're going to be able to appeal to people in a different way than, you know, your buttoned up kids. Your mm-hmm. buttoned up kids are probably pretty buttoned, pretty like straight and narrow.
Oh yeah.
And like, they're not going to be able to have the same appeal, unfortunately, mm-hmm. that you have.
Because I think
you have
about it all
you
the time,
have the experience,
Benny.
Right? Now they're going to be able to appeal to another set, right?
I think about it all the time.
But I almost feel like that God allows us to go through these things because he has big plans for us, especially the ones that are called.
I agree. You know? But we got to be willing, right? Because, yeah. I mean, that teenage, early 20s life was rebellious.
Is that why you joined the Army young?
It is.
Tell me a little bit about that. Was that like a way out for you?
It was.
Were you trying to prove
I would love to tell you I'm a patriot.
Were you trying? Know? I want to know the percentage on that. How many people are patriots versus how many people are just like, there's nowhere else
I gotta get
to
out
go.
Of here.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, you know, did you have to prove something to yourself? Like, what? And then also in the military, like, what part of you had to die there?
Mm.
You know, because I believe that I know a lot of people that went through the military, and whether they're conscious of it or not, I believe something dies there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and a lot of them.
It does.
And I also believe a lot of things come alive at the same time.
For sure.
And it's a very interesting little cocoon, caterpillar, butterfly mm-hmm. thing for some people, that military yeah. experience. So tell me all about why you did that, what happened, how it made you who you are today.
Yeah. So I wasn't Mr. Academia. And it wasn't because I wasn't smart. It was because I wasn't applying myself. You know, I was rebellious and I knew there was a God. I was mad at God because if there was a God, why would I be in this mess? Why would this be happening to us? All
that's
this another, stuff, right?
Podcast.
And so, you know, now I'm just mad at God. So, you know, I'm questioning everything. I explore college. And probably could have had a lot of benefits based off of our financial, but they said at minimum, you're gonna have to buy the books. And I'm like, how much are those? And they're telling me, and I'm like, this ain't happening. I wanted more, Benny. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't have direction. I didn't know if I was going to go be a coal miner, work in a steel mill. I didn't know what it was.
Those are the options in Southwest Pennsylvania.
That's what we do. Mm-hmm. And what I have is hard work. That's what I can bring to the world. You know, I worked the gardens, I worked the farms, you know, I grew up blue collar. Like, I can go sun up to sundown, let's do this. But I wanted something different. I wanted something more. The military had this thing called the GI Bill. You know, you probably heard of it, where if you go for a set amount of time, they'll pay all or a portion of your college. And I'm like, let's do this. And they're like, well, what is it that you want to do? And I'm like, well, what pays the most? And they're like, well, it's all rank thing. And they said, you know what I think you should do? That I said, I want something transferable. When I get out of the military, this isn't going to be a career for me. And they said, well, I think what we're going to do is we're going to make you a supply clerk with a dual MOS, and we're also going to make you the armorer, because that'll give you, you know, better positioning and all the stuff. And I'm like, let's do it. I was 17. I'm like, where do I sign? Like, you got to get your dad involved. You're not 17. So my dad, of course, signs it. You know, someone else feed this kid for a while. And so I graduated in June. September, I jumped on a plane for the very first time in my life, scared to death to fly. And I landed in Columbia, South Carolina, and found myself running Tank Hill at Fort Jackson. That experience, I can literally say I wouldn't be who I am today without it. This kid that had a chip on his shoulder, ready to throw hands with anybody that looked a certain way, acted a certain way. Well, you don't do that to drill sergeants. You don't do that. That doesn't fly. And they didn't care about me. They made that known. Like, what their model is unbelievable. It's changed. Whole nother conversation that I'm not happy about. But I will tell you, the model that was there was exactly what I needed to give me the structure that I needed, the discipline I needed, and most importantly, the confidence that I needed. Because confidence, to me, is the wild card of all wild cards. Marcus Garvey has one of my favorite quotes of all time, and he says, if you lack confidence in self, you're twice defeated in the race of life. But with confidence, you have won even before you start. That has resonated with me, but then comes the question, well, how do you build confidence? You do something you've never done, and you win a milestone. I did that in the gas chamber. I did that running Tank Hill. You know, I did that when I reached muscle failure. I did that when I did the 3-mile run. I did that on the rifle range. They helped build this confidence that I'm built for more. And that was the ignited flame that helped carry me into my corporate career.
Back to, like, give me, like, what died? What part of Jeff Hancher died in the military that never came back?
The arrogant, cocky one. And I didn't have much to be arrogant about.
So when you came back, how long did you do, 4 years?
Yeah, so, well, I did eight total with reserve.
So if somebody met you when you were 17 and didn't see you again until you were 26 or whatever, would they even recognize, like, would
no.
They even,
no. Totally different person. And when I decided to clean my life up, it was really, really hard. You know, because if you come from that way of life, you got your boys, your ride or dies. But this saying of show me your friends, I'll show you my future. And listen, if you're listening and you're one of them, I love you. I love you to death. But there was decisions that had to be made. You know, I almost lost my marriage. And there was things that I had to do. I needed to grow up. I needed to go another way. And it got super lonely. But that was the comment over and over, Benny, is like, who are you? I don't even know who you are anymore. Hindsight, in the moment, it hurt. Hindsight, it was like, that was the greatest compliment you could ever give me. You know, get around people that have been where you want to go. Get around rooms that challenge you in a healthy way. I wasn't doing any of this. You know, I was maybe standing out in certain crowds, but that wasn't saying a lot. Now, thankfully, a lot of those guys went on to be amazing.
So if someone's listening right now that's in that poverty, that bottom, that rock bottom of life, and they listen to this podcast, what can they do to get in a room what can they do to get in a room like that if they don't have money, if they don't have, you know, like I had to join a country club. It cost me $10,000 and 500 bucks a month.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, but like, how do, you know what I mean? So like, what other things can they do other than just pay their way in?
I think the first thing that you have to do, because you won't be able to do that, and I wasn't able to do that for years. Mm-hmm. But I think the first thing that you have to do is start changing who you are. You know, mm-hmm. Here's the thing. You will attract who you are, not what you want. We could want to be around wealth. We could want to be around influence. We could want to be around great leadership, great salespeople, people that have the formula to success. That's a want. But you will attract who you are, not what you want. Mm. Well, who are you? Well, if you're not who you want to be, change. And you can. You, that might mean going to Goodwill and buying a button-down shirt. Now, I'm not here to tell people what to wear. But I'm saying if you want to be a white-collar salesperson, you might want to ditch the Carhartt and the camo. There's a place for that too, and I love that. But I'm saying, who is it that you want to be, and are you starting to show up that way? I don't care what it is that you want to be, but are you showing up that way? Are you presenting yourself that way? Because that's when you'll start attracting it. And there's one question that will open up a whole new life for you, and it's this question. Who do you know that I don't know that you think I should meet? Who do you know that I don't know that you think I should meet? When I'm sitting down with coffee for somebody and I'm telling them my where I want my future to be, the impact I want to make, the dad that I want to be, the husband that I want to be, the future that I want for my family, and then I ask that question, they start directing me down a path. I write about Joe Bradley in the book. I write about Dan Billy in the book, about people that literally transformed who I have become. Now, some of that I got lucky and I got in a room and there was something about me that they were attracted to. But some of it was I had to leave my old ways. I had to show up giving something different off. It's so important to do this and to show up not where you are, but start beginning to act like who it is that you're trying to become. And there's ways that you can go about doing that, and slowly but surely, you start attracting that to yourself. Next thing you know, you have this community that intimidates you, but in the best of ways. And they're challenging you, and they're asking you, hey, has anybody ever showed you how to tie a tie? No. Do you own one? No. Would you like one? Yeah. You want me to show you how to tie one? I had a boss, Sean. It taught me how to tie a Windsor knot in the men's room. Mm. That's good stuff.
That's the best knot, too. My grandpa taught me how to
tie right?
Those, yeah.
I didn't know what a collar stay was. And then they got these metal ones. Those are like high-end.
High-end.
You kidding me?
Yeah.
I didn't know what any of this was. I didn't know the difference between a sport coat and a suit coat. I didn't know that your belt and shoes were supposed to match. I didn't know anything. When I tell you, like, I was the least likely candidate for any success, you're talking to him today. But these people stepped into my life, and for some reason, I attracted these people. And look, fake it till you make it gets hated on too much. I'm not saying to be a fake person, but I'm saying don't show up, arrive. Arrive into who you're becoming, not who you are. If I would have kept acting like who I was, I would have never transformed. But there were times in my life that I had to go back to that Jeremiah 9:11 that grandma spoke over and said, hey, it might not be the way it is now, but we're not staying here. And so I got to show up different. I got to act different. I got to move different. And I was willing to outwork my lack of skill. You got to be ready to go.
You mentioned a couple guys' names. You said those were people that believed in you, mentors.
Yeah.
I have a question about that. So do you remember a specific moment that one of those guys said something to you, made an impact on you? Like, what did they say, and why did it hit so hard?
Joe Bradley. Joe Bradley said these words to me. We called him Brad. We were coming out of a board meeting. I somehow got on this board for no good reason. I get on this board with CPAs, entrepreneurs, business owners, I mean, you name it. I had no business being in this meeting, in this board. It was a church board. And I used to like get a little bit radical in these meetings, not in a bad way, but I would like, I felt like I had to overcompensate because I didn't know what I was doing. So I'm like, just talk a little louder and, you know, hit your fist a few more times and make sure that they know that you mean business. Kind of, I was overcompensating for a lack of confidence. And one day, Brad and I were walking to the car, and this guy, man, I wish I could even explain him to you. He oozed confidence, but in the most tender way. He was the guy in the room that when he spoke, he was the quietest speaker ever. But when he spoke, the whole room got quiet because he carried such confidence and such wisdom. And we're walking to the car after I put on a show in one of the board meetings. And he says to me, he says, Jeff, you know, the greatest leaders that carry the greatest impact are the ones that are the most composed. Is that something you're interested in learning about? I said, I sure am. I had so many blind spots, as we all do, but here's a guy that saw it, but he saw potential. Mm-hmm. Next thing I know, I'm sitting there having coffee and breakfast with Brad, and he's in the most tender way calling me out and teaching me about composure. And what that taught me through time was, we don't, as leaders, as people of influence, we don't look at problems as problems. There's no reason to get worked up about them because we've been placed on this earth to solve problems. That's what we do. It's kind of like being a trauma surgeon. You go to school for 10, 15 years to be a world-class trauma surgeon in a big city in an emergency room. And day after day, imagine this, Benny, you're the trauma surgeon, and day after day, no trauma's coming through. Nobody's getting shot, nobody's getting stabbed. There's no head-on collisions. You know what starts happening to you? You become bored. You become discontent. Matter of fact, you become a little bit upset. And you say to your colleague, this stinks. We haven't seen action in days. And your colleague's like, what, Benny? Did you just say that you want trauma to happen to people? And you sit there and you think to yourself, I guess that's what I just said. That's not what I meant. Here's what you meant. You've been put on this world and you have a gift to solve a problem that most people have no clue how to. And if it's not happening in this city, I'm taking my talents elsewhere because this is what I'm built to do. And in essence, that's what Brad was telling me at that breakfast meeting, is like, you can't get all worked up. You can't get all emotional. Leaders are composed and they see problems as opportunities. This composure that Brad taught me, it transformed my leadership impact. That one stands out to me maybe most.
That was a good one. I want to get a little bit more into the book to give, that was great context about your life. And we're probably going to touch on a little bit more, but this book, Firm Feedback in a Fragile World, after hearing about your story in a little bit more vivid way, I can only imagine going from who you were as a 10, 17, 22-year-old kid to like someone now that's in a leadership role that has to give like, you know, composed feedback when the place is on fire, when people are not doing the right things, when, you know, there's a misalignment, right? And I understand how important this is. You know, Gary Vee talks about it, he calls it kind candor. Like, how do we give kind, candid feedback? Mm-hmm. And that's one of his biggest weaknesses. It's one of my biggest weaknesses because, again, we love people. We know how hard it is out there, and we want people to love us because we just wanted to be loved when we were little, right? Mm-hmm. And so then it's like, well, we don't want to be too hard on people.
Right.
It's
right.
Like this weird dichotomy.
It is.
And this is like the game changer. And so in the book, you say something about your assistant broke down in tears, mm-hmm. And said, I just don't feel like anything I do is good enough for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've heard that, I don't want to say 100 times, but I've probably heard it at least 7 or 8 times where I'm like, wow, someone had to.
They said it.
The oomph to like say that to me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, and I just like melt. Like, I'm like, No. So tell me a little bit more about what that moment taught you, not as a boss, but as a man of God.
This, I'm going to do whatever it takes to win mentality. I'll die on the hill. There was a time in my leadership journey that if that meant leaving bodies in the wake, I would. And it wasn't even that I was doing it intentionally. I was just chasing the prize. And you get running so hard, you just feel like we're all on the same page here. Why wouldn't everybody want to win? Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't everybody want to do 16, 17 hours if that's what it took to win? I don't understand. This is what we do. How bad do you really want it? Well, show me, right? It was this mentality. You know, I'm coming off the best year of my career. Meanwhile, I start as a entry-level truck driver, fill-in truck driver at this company. Blue collar, low rung. I work my way up into a sales leadership role. And life's good. I mean, I was driving a Honda Accord. You know what I'm talking about? Those are fancy cars. Like, I was living life. I mean, life was good. And I'm just running harder. It's never enough. Never enough money. Never enough. I'm coming off the best year of my life. I mean, I'm a sales manager of the region. My W-2 was bigger than it had ever been. Life is good. And I start getting some feedback around my leadership style. And one of them was Karen. Karen was my admin. Karen was the ride or die of all ride or dies. We had been in this journey a while together. I'm talking about, like, I would buy her kids birthday gifts kind of relationship.
Wow.
Right? And so Karen gets me. I get Karen. She's running with me. She's running hard.
My sister almost.
Oh, literally.
Yeah.
I write about her, right? I mean, we're coming off of this great year. And I just went too far. I went too hard. I was killing people, literally. I got the trophy, though, by the way. And so, what's the problem? And Karen came in for our weekly debrief, and she was in there waiting on me, and I come in, and her head's down, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, man, something must be off at home. And I just said, hey, man, you okay? Everything okay? Is your family okay? And she looks up, couldn't even say a word. And here comes the tear. Boom, falls. Boom, falls. And there come the words. I feel like no matter how hard I try and all the sacrifices that I make, it's never good enough for you. She might as well have taken my heart and ripped it out, because that's not who I am. How could she be saying this? I don't get it. Well, Karen's love language is a lot different than mine. You know, I want the trophy. I want the affirmation. I need some validation here. That's not Karen's love language. You know, I tell leaders all the time, if your favorite snack is a Snickers, don't put it on a fishing hook if you're fishing. They don't eat Snickers. They like worms. You know, they like flies. I wasn't feeding Karen what she needed to thrive. And it hit me so hard, but not enough to change. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until my performance review that same year that I got the worst score in the employee engagement section. I got a 2 out of 4. 2 means needs improvement. Me, Jeff Hancher. I had never gotten a 2 in my life. You got the wrong guy. Hey, you were the one that handed me the trophy up there on that stage. We need to get some white out. This can't be right. And he said, I know this is hard. This was my boss at the time. I know this is hard for you to hear, but somebody's got to tell you. And you've probably had people in this company that never said a word because they enjoyed your results. I'm not that guy. I'm not gonna rob you of reaching your potential. And I'm giving you a 2 because you need to improve. He said, your turnover was horrible last year. There's no trophies for that, I understand. But if we were giving trophies out for the worst turnover in the region, you would have gotten a big one. The only thing we celebrated was total sales and whatnot. He's like, but I'm not gonna be impressed, Jeff, until I see you reach your potential and you're not even sniffing it. He pulls 3 50-cent pieces out of his pocket, throws them on the desk. And he said, this isn't a suggestion, it's a job requirement. Every morning you get up, I want you to take these 3 50-cent pieces, put them in your left pocket. Your day is not allowed to end until they all 3 end up in your right pocket. And the only way they can get there is if you catch somebody doing something right and you tell them about it. The words that followed that was this: if you're gonna make big withdrawals, you gotta make big deposits. I thought I was a good sales leader. And I had trophies to prove it. I hadn't even scratched the surface. This deposit withdrawal thing, this earning the right to have a tough conversation, you know, this, like you said, kind candor. Here's the formula for that. Earn the right to do it. When you earn the right to tell somebody tough feedback, it's a gift. It's a gift. They might not even like it, but it's a gift because you earned the right. Hopefully that's how we parent our kids.
I think I remember, if you don't do that, you're a monster.
You are a monster. You are. That's my word.
Yeah.
You have to earn the right, because if not, you're a monster. And here's a role play to prove it. You're a good sport, so I know you'll be fine with this. Me and you, we're going to a big business convention in Nashville in 2 weeks, and we're going there to learn about podcasting and keynote speaking and masterminds, and me and you are going together. We're going to meet a lot of people, Benny. If we're walking into this event, and I smell maybe you have bad coffee breath, or your breath's just stinking,
mm-hmm.
would you want me to tell you?
Mm-hmm.
Why would that be important to you?
Because I don't want the next 1,000 people to get that impression and not tell me.
Yeah, right.
and like waste 3 days of like, you know, turning people off.
Yeah, and you know what I've learned about you mm-hmm. in the time that I've known you is that it matters to you that people are seen and heard.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had that kind of breath, that would hold you back from that goal.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want that to happen to you. So, Benny, you can count on me. I'll be there to do that for you if needed. 2 weeks go by, we're at the event, we're walking in. And I smell it. And I pull a mint out of my pocket and I say, Benny, you remember a couple weeks ago we had that conversation? Brother, I got a mint. What do you say to me?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Give me two.
Give me two of them suckers. Role reversal, same data, stinky breath. You're behind me in the convenience store. We've never talked before, never had a conversation. It's the same exact data. And I turned around to you and I say, sir, your breath stinks. Now you're offended. Who are you to tell me? I didn't ask. Nobody asked you, pal.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. It's the same exact data. In one scenario, I earned the right to serve you with a tough conversation. In the other one, I didn't. In one, I made a deposit. In the other, I made a withdrawal. This is the mistake that a lot of leaders make, is that they just call out what's right. You're right, his breath stinks. Do you want to be right, or do you want to be effective? Right and effective can be miles apart. I'm hopeful that the framework of this book helps leaders be more effective with the tough conversations.
Cody, do I need a mint?
I'm just
kidding. You never know, though. And that's got me like, you know, woo! Was that like real life feedback? I have no idea.
No, it was not. Minty fresh, like, from my perspective.
That's so interesting.
Minty fresh.
Wow, that was really good. There's another powerful through line in this book about avoiding conflict, right? Because that's what I like to do, like especially with my people. Like, you know, there's situations I can tell you time and time after again. It's like, man, I don't really know how to tell her that because I know she's going to take it the wrong way.
Yeah.
But man, it's really driving me nuts. Mm. And I'm like, you know what? It's just not worth it. Anyway, avoiding conflict is like one of the things that, like, I don't know, I'm sometimes addicted to it. It's weird, though, because like with my wife and with my kids, I'm not, and I should be a little bit more there. But with people at work, it's like, man, because like I need them.
Mm.
And I don't want them to run away. I don't want them to feel awkward. Mm-hmm. And especially now that I'm in a more virtual world, because like my assistant lives in Phoenix, my marketing director lives in Tennessee. I got videographers in Florida, like all over the place. I got the team now. And on Zoom, it's just like, yeah, phone calls. Mm. It's hard to do anyway. So as far as that avoiding conflict, we're also avoiding connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I love to connect with people, but in a positive way, you know, mm-hmm. and then I almost think that people can sense when I'm avoiding them, because I'm not, like, they can feel my presence and they can feel when I'm connected.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you can feel like when you're connected to your wife, like,
sure.
It's just like instant, right?
Like, yeah. And when you're not, you feel that too.
Yeah. And then you're like, all right, what did I do wrong? What's going on, yeah. babe? Like, you know, and so Why do you think people are so emotionally fragile? Because I feel like that's, you know, I'm fragile. The other person on the other end is fragile. Mm-hmm. And how does Jesus model the kind of strength that we need more of?
Well, why is it fragile to begin? There's a lot going on. In my opinion, it's never been harder to lead than now. Now, I'm saying that because I'm living in the earth. I'm sure the Great Depression, they would, you know, debate that. But look at what we got going on. I mean, you got social injustice. You got everybody arguing about politics. You know, we're post-pandemic. Are we going back to the office? Are we not? You make me go to the back to the office, I quit. Simple as that. We've come through the Great Resignation, a spirit of YOLO. You have quiet quitting that's costing the global economy $9 trillion a year. Every leader that's listening, by and large, has an open job that they're trying to fill. They're fighting hard to keep top talent. It's fragile. Then combine that with, I've never been taught how to give feedback, and I'm certainly not going to pull them in and have a conversation because they're probably going to cry. I know her. I know him. They're going to cry. I'm not gonna pull that person in because they're gonna flip. They're Mr. Defensive. No matter what you say, not me, you got the wrong one. They already know what's gonna happen. And so they already have this bias of what's going to happen. Here's what I tell leaders all the time. You don't look at feedback as good or bad. It's just information. The key is earning the right to dive into the conversation. And I haven't forgotten your second part, but I have to tell a story that solidifies this. That leader that I told you taught me how to tie a tie, he taught me what a collar stay was. He took me to Joseph A. Bank and told me how to look as a white collar sales professional. He was also the guy that whenever I was sucking at sales would allow me to stay after work, and he would role play with me in his office and teach me interest creating statements and feel felt found and how to overcome objections. He would jump in that Honda Accord and sit in on sales calls and coach me afterward. He would take my sales calls and let me observe the sensei. I mean, this is a guy that's making deposits, and he let me be humble, and he let me be wrong. You know, he never came up to me and said, look, I know you come from nothing, so I'm here to help. Hey, I know you don't know what the heck you're doing, and I'm here to help. No, he was so humble about doing it. And I'm having some success my rookie season. Like, they're telling me, like, you keep up this nonsense, you're going to end up in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor for President's Club. And I'm like, let's do this. And we're going into Q4, and I'm about to run the last lap of this year. And I got a call from my dad that I had gotten so many times in my life, which was, you got to get to the hospital. It's not looking good. Well, not that you get numb to that call, but when you've gotten that call hundreds of times, it's not that you ignore the call, you go, but it's gonna be fine. Well, not this day. I got there just in time to hold my mom. For the last time. And there was this feeling of like everything that I was working so hard for was gone. You know, we had just been looking at nice houses in neighborhoods to get them out of the one-bedroom apartment. Mom always would bounce back. All of a sudden, Benny, I didn't really care about the Honda Accord and the Joseph A. Bank suit. I went into a pretty dark place and almost reverted back to who I used to be because it was comfortable and it's what I knew. I didn't really care about sales commissions. I certainly didn't care about going to the Broadmoor. I didn't even own luggage. That boss, Sean, after about 2 weeks, he pulled me into his office and he said, enough's enough. I'm not going to let you ruin your potential. You have an 18-month-old son. You have a beautiful wife. And I know you want more kids. And I know that part of your motivation to win was certainly your mom, and my heart breaks. But there are people counting on you to win, and I'm not going to let you fail. But I'm certainly not going to let you keep acting the way that you are. He said, I'm going to give you 24 hours. You can go home. and tomorrow I want you to come back and let me know, are you going to be the person I know you can be? But if you can't, I just need to let you know, you won't be on my team. Whoa. The old Jeff would have said, screw you, pal. You're not going to tell me how to live my life. I'm a self-made man. I figured it out before I'll figure it out without you. Here was the difference. It was coming from a heart of compassion, of love. Who takes their salesperson into the bathroom for an hour and a half and teaches them how to tie a knot? That's not his responsibility. It's not his responsibility to stay till 8 o'clock at night teaching me how to overcome objections. I knew the guy cared. He earned the right to have the tough conversation. Think about what's happened since that moment. I went on to have 11 promotions, multiple president's clubs, built a life that I didn't even know was possible, had enough confidence to leave the job that I loved to start my own company, publishing a book. Why do I tell the listener that? Because I want you to know I'm amazing? No, because I'm here to tell you that there is somebody like a young Jeff Hancher that is begging you to show up like Sean did in that moment and save you from total devastation. And so the follow-up question is, how do we love more like Jesus did? It's the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know, I'm not really big into the law of reaping and sowing, not because I don't believe in it, because if we focus more on sowing and less about reaping, we can really serve some people. What is your motivation? What is your why, leader? What I have found is whenever you truly, genuinely care about people and you love them and you want to see them reach their fullest potential, you don't see them as burdens and problems. By the way, let me help a bunch of people out. If you don't genuinely want to see people win, don't be a leader. It's like petting a cat backwards. Why would you? The cat's miserable, you're miserable, nobody's having a good time. Don't be a leader.
I didn't know that was a thing about cats.
You know? I mean, try petting a cat backwards. They're going to hate it, right?
Oh, man.
We have to love people and make deposits. There's not a leader walking planet Earth today that has all the answers. But I can tell you this. Above all these things, love. Above all these things, love. All the fruits of the Spirit, and the greatest of these is love. If I had to give somebody one piece of advice on how to become a better leader, it's love well and challenge well. So many people are afraid to love well because they're going to be taken advantage of. You know the nice guy? Mm-hmm. Well, the nice guy gets taken advantage of because they don't have boundaries and they don't know how to hold people accountable. You need to be able to look somebody in the face like Sean did and say enough's enough.
How do the people, if there's people listening, like I feel like 99% of my audience wants that.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we learn how to do that?
The framework is simple and not easy. The framework is three parts. It's setting clear and reasonable expectations, providing frequent feedback on those expectations.
That's the part that most of us don't want to do.
Yes. But if you set clear expectations, you earn the right to give the feedback.
I know, it's just the consistency of the feedback that like most that's of us entrepreneurs, key. It's almost like we got to hire that guy to do that.
When I get called into companies, Benny, it's because they're bleeding.
Oh.
They're bleeding, their turnover's high, their leadership is toxic. They're calling me in because there's a major problem. Mm. And I ask a series of questions. And one of the questions that I ask is this, is every employee in your company getting a frequent one-on-one debrief with their boss? Almost never.
Never.
Is that happening? Number one reason? We don't have time for that. Then you need more leaders. Then you need to prioritize what time is. Because I'm here to tell you, I will not consult a company that's not committed to that. I won't do it. I'm out. You don't have a big enough bankroll for me to take on that project. Because what you're telling me is you don't value people. I'm out. I'm not ever going to do that. And I'm not here to say it's easy. But I will tell you, even if you suck as a leader, and you don't know what the heck you're doing, and you give somebody this powerful thing spelled T-I-M-E, you can start reproducing yourself and other people by giving them time, by asking questions. Mm. That's the feedback piece. The problem is you have the aggressive leader. They're great at giving feedback, aren't they? stop that, you moron, throw a chair, it's whatever it might, right?
It's all negative feedback.
Oh, yeah, and they're the ones that'll introduce themselves that way. Exactly.
And, or they were in the military, and that's how they do it there, too.
That's it. And by the way, when you're aggressive, you can get good results. And that scares me to death with the aggressive leaders. Because I'll say, listen, man, you need to change. You got so much more runway left as a leader. And they say, well, look at my balance sheet, pal. I'm killing it. Yeah. And that's when I say to them, imagine how much better you could be. But then you got the passive leader who loves a good sheet cake and a, you know, pinata party. And I mean, they got birthday cards flying. They got baby gifts going. They got it all going on. And the person quits and they say, hey, it's not you, passive leader. You're the best thing since sliced bread. But they quit you and they quit you and they take advantage of you. And you go home and talk to your significant other or whoever you talk to, and you say these words, and this is going to resonate with somebody. After all I've done for them. After all I've done for them, and they treat me like that, here's why. This is going to hurt. They like you. They don't respect you. You're a doormat. You have not given them any feedback or the accountability they need. Can you imagine expectations? The speed limit's 55. That's an expectation. It's posted. It's clear. And they tell us frequently down the road, don't they? Not once at the on-ramp. But can you imagine a world where there was never a speeding ticket? Ever? Never even heard of it ever happening. Nobody would take those speed limit signs seriously. Adversely, no speed limit signs, and you just start getting pulled over. And they start throwing tickets in the window, you would feel abused and they would be a monster. Right in the middle is what's healthy. The speed limit's 55. Here's why. On this stretch of road, 18 people have died in the last 60 days, all because of excessive speed. I can't allow that for you and your family. So I'm giving you a ticket today. Now check this out. If I ask you, why were you speeding? And you say, my 10-year-old daughter is having a seizure. You know what I'm allowed to do as a police officer? I'm allowed for you to break the law. And I'm going to say, I'm going to flip the lights on. How fast are you comfortable driving? I can always make an exception. So we don't have to be rigid leaders, but we have to have clear, reasonable expectations. Don't put a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit sign on a stretch of freeway. That's not reasonable. Don't ask people to run a 4-minute mile. I know that's what your company needs, but you got people with titanium knees. Don't do that. Adequately train them to meet or exceed the expectation. Why? Because that builds confidence. And then on a frequent cadence, that might be a week, every week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever it is for you, update them on how they're doing as it relates to the expectation. If they're running a 10-minute mile, get them the right shoes. Get them a running coach. Get them the right shorts to wear. Don't let them show up at the starting line with steel toe boots. Give them that feedback ongoing. But guess what? Every human is going to test you. They're going to blow it. And that's when you have earned the right to hold them accountable the same way as me and you going into that business convention. We set an expectation. Mm-hmm. We talked about feedback, why it was important. I now have set the table to have the tough conversation. Accountability doesn't need to be hard and avoided. And it's like you're walking the green mile, your chest is tightening, you're sweating all over the place. No, it's a gift. And you can create an environment that is that way with this framework. I believe it.
That's exciting. Wow. This is a love letter then, is what I'm hearing.
It is.
Who's it written to?
Well, my wife is who I write the book to. She's the greatest leader I know.
Did she need that? Does she need this
book? No.
Okay.
No.
So who'd you write it to?
She does not. I wrote it to the leaders that have a young Jeff Hancher that needs them. Mm. You know, leadership is the highest calling on planet Earth. And when I say leadership, I'm talking about the title of mom, the title of dad, the title of boss. Leadership is the highest calling on planet Earth. And feedback, if you think about this deeply, you, me, this entire crew, everybody listening, we're a product of the feedback we've been given or the feedback that has been missing. When you're in a leadership role, you have a voice. When I do these workshops, Benny, people leave them all the time and they tell us this. Nobody's ever taught us this. I also hear this. This should be a parenting workshop. And I always say the same thing. Who told you it wasn't? I wrote this book so that leaders can make big impact. Why? Because there are people that are counting on us as leaders to show up and borrow our belief in them. I borrowed the belief that Sean had in me, and I could go down the list of the other leaders, like a Joe Bradley, like a Dan Billy, that was like, listen, I know you don't believe it, but I see it.
Are those guys still alive?
Brad has passed. Brad has passed. I just posted about him,
like,
actually.
Part of me like wants to go, like, you know, this is a rabbit trail, but part of me wants to go interview all those people about you to hear like more of those stories, because I feel like that's a...
I surprised.
This is like a movie. I feel like this is a mini documentary about firm feedback in a fragile world and how to go about it, but that's, I sidetracked.
You know, it's funny you say that. Have you ever seen Hillbilly Eulogy?
No.
You got to watch it. You have to watch it.
Okay.
Write it down, Cody. Have you guys seen that? It's the story about J.D. Vance.
Oh, really?
It's insane.
Well, I'll have to check it out.
100 people told me, you got to watch this movie. This is your life. You got to watch this movie. I could hardly get through it. Like, if you want the closest thing.
Me and Brittany will be watching it tonight. Is it on Netflix?
It's the closest thing to my life story that you're going to get.
All right. What's it called again?
Hillbilly Eulogy.
Hillbilly Eulogy.
The title will make sense.
And so right before we got off to that rabbit trail, you were talking about leadership.
Yeah.
You were talking about it's the highest calling. Mm-hmm. You know, it sounds to me a lot like what Jesus did. And I'm curious, you know, is your work actually leadership or is it ministry in disguise?
I think it's yes. I think it's yes.
To both?
I think it is.
Yeah,
I really do. Mm-hmm. I guess I would answer it by saying this. I believe what I'm doing is what I'm called to do. I believe what I'm doing is what I was put on this planet to do. And so, yes, is that going to help people? Look, leadership is about influence, full stop. Like, let's get over the titles. You know, whether you're a volunteer in ministry, a nonprofit, or you're a for-profit, you know, at the workplace, at the corporation, let's get over the titles. Let's realize this. There's a difference between appointed authority and earned authority. You know, appointed authority is you're the boss. All right, great. Earned authority comes from reverent authority and expert authority. That's what we're striving for as leaders, is to be somebody that says, I passionately care, I want you to feel it, and I can take you somewhere. Mm. I can take you somewhere. When you have that, you become not a boss that people report to. You become a leader that people don't want to let down. That hits different.
What should you do if you're an entrepreneur that like hears what you're speaking about and like is like, wow, like, cause me, I'm like, I wish I had a leader like you in my life. Just the way you're talking right now, like if I would have had someone like you in my life, like God knows like where I would be at right now. Like, I would be like 10,000 planets away probably. Like I never had anybody like this in my life, ever in my life. And I can only imagine that that's the story for about 95% of us.
Right.
If once we realize that, do we just keep going on and trying to figure out how we make it? Or do we come work for someone like you? Do we figure out like, because part of me is like, all right, I need to shut all this down and just go like, just, I don't know, take the next job opening that you have.
Yeah, even there is that, something
like,
to do.
Even though that goes against my entrepreneur, like, you know, oh, like it's gotta be like, you know, it's like, cause it's an interesting place. Cause I mean, I feel like when you get to where I'm at in life, there's not too many things I crave, but I crave that.
Yeah, that's right, whatever everybody
that,
does.
Whatever that is.
Everybody does, I do. We all do to some way, shape or form. You know, there's a saying that I like, which is follow the leader. Mm-hmm. And people call me all the time for advice. And one of the things I always get asked is this question of, should I leave my job because there's another one down the road that is offering more money? I don't talk about money. I'm asking about leadership. Mm. I'm asking about culture. You know, short-term, long-term thinking. Short-term is I want to make more money. Long-term is I want to build wealth. Right? There's a difference between how to make money and how to build wealth. You know this. It's the same thing is if you want long-term success, you have to get around people that have been where you're going. Mm-hmm. There's things that a university is never going to teach you. There is things that a company is never going to teach you. It's for this reason that when great leaders leave a company, there's a high rate of turnover. Why? Because they're following them. They're following them. When you have something to offer, look, you want a great recruiting strategy? Build great leaders. Build great leaders. It's the best recruiting strategy on planet Earth. It's not marketing. It's not paying people more. It's not better benefits. It's not a ping pong table in the break room. It's leadership. Full stop. It's leadership. You could have the best product, service, benefits in the world with mediocre or poor leadership and lose.
But there's not like a surplus of leaders, like leaders around.
That's why this is so important.
Yeah, but like you're talking like,
this
there's
is
way
taught.
More entrepreneurs than there are leaders. And they're way more like there's like those people that you're describing. You know, they always say like a visionary, like there's 4-1 over like his integrator,
right
hand person. But then a real leader, like the leader that you're describing, I feel it's probably gotta be like 10-1 versus the amount of company. It's just like harder to get.
Yeah.
And
it's
so
true.
It's like, where do you go get one at?
Well,
how do you attract one if you're not really like,
you don't even know where to go.
Well, how do you attract someone like that's better than you?
It's true.
See what I'm saying?
Well,
like, how do you do that?
I mean, the good news is it is taught. It can be taught.
Yeah, I can see
leadership
that.
Is taught. I'm living proof.
Yeah, we can.
Right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I was
the
a
guy,
derelict,
the guy that
right?
Rolled a truck 3 times.
Literally, like
yeah.
It's possible. Here's the thing about leadership and a lot of things on the journey to success. There's some things that are better caught than taught. Leadership is one of those things. I'm not telling you don't read the book. Like, I hope you read the book. But that would be like reading a book that Tiger Woods wrote and expecting to play golf well.
Yeah.
Now, if you're playing 18 holes with Tiger every Sunday, the odds of your game improving are significantly better. Read his book because at least you have head knowledge. But let me say this. We're not here to win leadership trivia. We're here to make impact. Get around it. I mean, look, it's why I'm so passionate. It's why I quit my job, because I want to serve as many people with this gift as I can. And it is a gift. Like, when you have leadership impact, you now have a gift to the world. You literally have the ability to transform a life, a generation or generations, in my case, of people. Like, let's go get this, and don't make excuses, entrepreneur. Don't make excuses, leader. Well, that's how I was raised. Well, that's how I saw it done. That's an excuse. There are answers out there to become a better leader. And for the blue collar person that grew up tough and you were mistreated and all of this, I'm here to break the news. You can love people well and be tough. Think of your Mount Rushmore of leaders, Benny. These are like four people you would be like, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be who I am. I wouldn't be who I am today. Were those four people tough on you?
Mm-hmm.
Did they care?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody that's listening is answering the question the same way. It's possible.
Mm.
It's possible. Our Mount Rushmore of leaders were tough on us. We never for a second questioned if they cared. Mm. We can care deeply and hold people accountable. Not everybody's going to adapt. Here's one thing we can't teach in leadership, and that's willingness. Not everybody's going to be willing to adhere to the speed limit. That's why we have speeding fines. And sometimes we got to take their license. And sometimes we got to put them in jail. There has to be accountability to the expectation, or it means nothing. But we can, even through it all, we can still care about them. Mm. We just can't let them do that.
So I think the hardest people to lead is your family.
Hmm.
And you talk about your wife and kids a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know what fatherhood has taught you about leadership, and then what has it also exposed about your own wounds?
I've expected way too much from my kids. I wanted them to be what I never was. And now look, if you ask my kids, they would say, I hope I have the greatest dad on the planet, right? But I feel like there were times that I just pushed too hard. Like, how cool is it to have a kid that's in the National Honor Society. That's pretty freaking cool.
Yeah, you couldn't even spell that.
I didn't even know what it was.
Yeah.
You kidding me? I was like trying to get through. I mean, if it wasn't for Cliff's Notes, I would have never made it. Like, I didn't read a book legit until I was like 23. Wow. Now, I could look back and say, I don't want that for my kids, but that pendulum started swinging a little too far the other way. You know, I remember one time flipping out on my son about a pair of Air Jordans that he was playing in the yard with. You what? You know, when I came home from school back in the day, we had play clothes because you didn't wear school clothes to play in. Well, my kids don't know about that life. And my man's out in the yard with mud on the J's. What?
Probably white ones, too.
You did what? Do you know what's on your foot, son? That's Air Jordan. We're talking about the GOAT.
Be reverent to
the GOAT. Not even going into the debate. He's the GOAT.
Okay.
And this childhood adversity, it probably pushed my kids a little too much. Mm. I'm thankful to say I have an amazing wife that tempers that when I'm not around. I think my kids know I love them very, very well. I push them hard. I'm not really apologizing for that. But if I had to go back and do it again, I would have probably been less emotional when my son missed a tackle on the field. You know,
were you one of those guys?
I could be.
Were you?
Well, yes, and I'll tell you why. I wasn't that guy.
Actually be a coach, right?
No. I might go on record as being the only fan that got a technical foul.
I can believe that.
That happened. Why? I quit playing sports in high school. One of the biggest regrets in my life, because I had to work. And so, like, I'm providing this opportunity for my kids. And my kids were amazing athletes, by the way, and, you know, all the things. But I was trying to live my life through them. Mm. So much so, I'll show you a picture of a treehouse I built for them sometime. This thing is like a small house in a tree.
Like, it's got, like, its own Zillow.
I could Airbnb it, no problem. They never went in it.
Oh, that made you mad.
Mad. Like, I'm saying to my wife, who in their right mind wouldn't want to spend time in a treehouse like this? I had to go down to the Giant Eagle and pick up, like, wooden crates and cut them by hand and try to make this. I mean, I would have died for something like this. And she asked me this million-dollar question. Did anybody ever ask for a treehouse? I said, no. Maybe they didn't want one. Well, what kid doesn't want one? So this constantly me trying to make them something I wish I was.
Love language thing.
Oh, my gosh.
Like you said earlier in the show, it's the same thing just with your kids instead of employees.
Yes. So I had to battle through that. I'm not the best dad in the world, but I love them dearly.
What's something that your kids will never have to go through because you chose to face the fire of your own story?
Making me emotional again. You know, a big part of my life is that my kids would never, and my grandkids would never experience any kind of pain like that. And now I'm in a place that I don't want anybody to feel that kind of pain. And what am I going to do about it? The first thing I thought of when you asked me that question was holding my mom when she would have seizures. I think about the stacked up metal coffee cans in the place they were in the kitchen. And, you know, part of my job was to cut little squares out of that metal coffee can and pop rivet them to the floor of our car so that snow wouldn't kick up and gravel. Me being the one that would have to go over to the landlord and tell him we don't have the rent money. Because if you send a kid, it hits different. I think of those things. I'm not here to tell you my kids haven't had some level of adversity, but I will say the hard work is worth it. You know, and if I can say this to the person that might be watching, that's like, man, this dude's resonating with me. Maybe you're 21, 22, you don't know how to get there, but you want a different life for your kids as well. find the balance, change your life. But I will tell you this, it's going to come at a price. For me, it was worth it. But somebody's got to pay a price tag. If you're looking to change lives and looking to change literally a generation and a curse of poverty and, you know, all of these things, somebody's got to pay that price. Be willing to do it, because you may not even, you know, there's an African proverb that says the guy that plants the tree will never enjoy the shade. Plant the tree. Plant the tree.
So there's a listener, I'm just picturing these listeners and the people watching, and they're feeling like they're unworthy to lead like Jeff Hancher.
Mm-hmm.
They're feeling unworthy to lead like Jesus. And probably because they failed too much, right? Because they're ashamed of things that they've done in their past.
Mm-hmm.
They've been hurt too, like, deep, like it's like in the core, like it's like someone stuck the knife in and just keeps twisting it and then pouring salt in it, and they can't really find that voice. You know, they're hearing the polished Jeff Hancher,
right?
You know, they don't know 17 year old Jeff Hancher. What do you say to them right now?
Chase incremental improvement. You know, there's a couple fundamental things that changed my journey. You know, when you're at base camp of Mount Everest and you're looking at the top, it's almost easier to say it's not worth it, because you're looking clear at the top of that. Sir Edmund Hillary, who was the first to get to the top, he didn't see it that way. We know that he got there. He was the first one to get there. He had help getting there, but he got there and he was the first, but it wasn't on the first try. And there was a time, I don't know how many tries it was, but he fails after getting so close to the summit, and he's got to admit failure and turn back around. And one of his most famous quotes ever came in one of his biggest attempts, failed. He's almost back to base camp, and this rage bubbles up in him of this failure. And he turns back around and looks at the mountain and he says, I'm coming back and you won't be bigger, but I'll be better. This journey can feel like, how will we ever get there? That vision that you have in your mind, that life that you can taste, that you can feel, how in the world are we ever going to get there? Don't worry about the top. Worry about, how am I just going to get to the next step? Two things that can literally change who we become: what we consume and who we surround ourselves with. I'm grateful that I've met you. You've done things I haven't done. You have skills that I don't have. You challenge me. You love well. Like, there's things about you that I want to be more like. That's the way it was with Dan Billy and Sean, and I could go down the list. What you consume and who you surround yourself with. We're all going to be in one of four camps in this life. Camp one is, I hope it doesn't come up. Camp two is, if it comes up, I'll wing it. Camp three is, if it comes up, I'll talk about it. But then there's camp four, and camp four is, if it doesn't come up, I'm bringing it up. And I'm going to tell you, it's hard to get into camp four, because you got to consume and you got to get around it and you got to be hungry and watching the YouTube videos and watching shows like this. And I mean, look, we're talking to an amazing audience that's investing already. I'm preaching to the choir. But I'm here to tell you this: when you're in camp four, you have answers to problems and you don't feel arrogant. You feel obligated. If you know CPR and someone in the grocery store yells, help, help, they're not breathing, you're not thinking, well, I don't want to be showy. I don't want to be arrogant. No, you're running to death to breathe life into death. Why? Because in that moment, you're camp four. If you don't know CPR, you're in camp one. Hope that doesn't happen today in the grocery store. You want to get into camp four, you better be willing to pay the price, right? You better be willing to give up what you want now for what you want most. Most people aren't. Most people aren't. Most people would rather be at happy hour than in a workshop.
What an episode of the Big Fish Cares podcast, I could have recency bias, but I would probably like to say this was the best show we've ever done.
Mm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well.
Thank
that
you.
That was really good, man. Is there anything that we missed or didn't cover? That was wild.
No.
I hold it all together.
You can find me easily. It's yeah. Jeff Hancher, like Jolly Rancher, but with an H. You'll find everything you need to know.
Brother, I don't know where you came from, but like, this is amazing.
I'm grateful for the opportunity. Grateful yeah. our paths have crossed, truly.
Yeah, this is so good. You know, I'm glad I got this message today. I'm glad you guys got this message today, but man, I wish I had this message when I was, would I have listened to
Me
this
too.
When I was 18?
I wouldn't have.
I probably wouldn't have listened to it. So I guess it's no. wherever it happens, it's happening for a reason.
That's right. It's about right now.
Yeah, I'm excited. Man, this is, whew. Do you guys like this? How do you guys feel back there? I'm just curious. You want a book?
Mm.
Well, you can have mine. I'll get another one. That's it. All right. We can find you there. Buy the
yeah.
book. If you have questions, drop them in the comments. I'll get them over to Jeff. But thanks for being here, brother. This was special.
Thank you, my friend. Appreciate you.
Yep.
Grateful for you.
We'll see you on another edition of the Big Fish Cares podcast. Like, subscribe, do all those things. I know I'm really bad at promoting the podcast, but this is what we do. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Big Fish Cares podcast.